Today we continue in our analysis of the text of the exam given at February the 6th, 2019, and in particular to the questions that are required at the end of the text. Let's consider the first one that asks to show how is the shape of the power supply of a step motor without the inductor in the chopper circuit. In this case, we must go to the slide 104 of the digital interfacing block. And we see the circuit that is roughly called the chopper circuit. That is a circuit devoted to the management of the power supply to the stepper motor, featuring the implementation of a PWM, pulse width modulation approach. This is clearly implemented, carried out, I mean, through the presence of the flip-flop that is synchronized by a switchable clock. This flip-flop opens or closes the switch that provides a high voltage to the motor itself. The current that crosses the motor is responsible for a voltage drop down on the resistor R, and this voltage is compared with a suitable threshold by means of an operational amplifier. The response of this comparator, let's say, is the command that is used to open or close the switch, so applying or not applying, following the PWM principle, the high voltage to the motor itself. Of course, we have to regulate the duration of the application of the voltage, and this is the reason why we have a flip-flop synchronized with a suitable clock whose duration, whose time interval and the period is managed by a microprocessor. You see that in the circuit we have also an inductor and a diode, and you know that the diode is used to allow the discharging of the accumulated charge in the inductors of the stepper motor during the no conduction, let's say, no supplying phase, while the inductor, the single inductor present in the circuit, is used to make the response of the motor more smooth. And this is the point on which the question of the exam is focused. In other words, we know that this kind of electronic component allows to make sweeter the commutation of the signal applied to the motor itself, and therefore to diminish the mechanical solicitation to the components of the motor, so prolonging its life. The idea is that the inductor, as the electronic laws say, features a delay in answering to an input solicitation. We know, in fact, that the current is given by the integral function of the applied voltage divided by the impedance value of the inductor itself. The integrator concept introduces a delay in the response of the inductor itself. And this is the idea we want to exploit, because this means that the abrupt commutation that would be implemented through the flip-flop and the switch that provides a high voltage or not to the motor is, let's say, in some sense, compensated, or if you want, make a little bit sweeter by the fact that the response of the motor will be not immediate, but will, let's say, follow a ramp that is a linear more or less increment when solicited, and the same behavior will be implemented when the power supply will be no more applied to the bottle itself. Therefore, the answer to the question is, if we eliminate the inductor from the circuit, the shape of the signal applied to the motor will remain a perfect PWM, that is a perfect pulse with a edge, raising edge at the beginning, then a certain amount of power provided for a certain interval of time determined by the duty cycle of the signal, and then a falling edge that corresponds to the instant into which the switch is open. Of course, by eliminating the inductor, once more we highlight that the abrupt edge falling and rising will solicit a lot the motor, so reducing its life. The second question says that if a silicon control rectifier is used to power supply a motor of a ship, what it is better, to choke the power within a single period or to select the periods into which the power is provided and those into which the power is not provided? Again, we are making reference to the digital interfacing section, and in particular to those slides that present the usage of a SCR TRIAC device when providing a power supply to a load that can be resistive, capacitive, or inductive. And in particular, we are considering if in this specific case we supply the motor of a ship, it is better to select the periods or to partialize the periods, that is, to provide a certain amount of power within a period, and for the remaining part of the period we avoid to provide anything. Okay, first of all, let's consider the particular problem we deal with. That is, we are supplying a motor. Okay, the model of the motor is characterized by an effective torque, a friction, and a inertia. That is, we consider that part of the energy of the force that the motor is able to exert on the load is split in two components that are lost, since they are passive, friction and inertia, and another component that is effective, meaning with this that it produces a real work, a real activity. But in this case, it is not important the motor, as it is instead the load, the object to which the motor is applied, that is a ship. And into a ship, of course, we will have frictions, we will have inertia. Therefore, that is the real component that must be considered in this case. And since we have a big inertia, and we know that the inertia represents into a load characteristic that is similar to an energy accumulator, that is, in terms of equivalent electronic circuit, a capacitor, we can say that the particular load that we are considering could be considered sensible not to the immediate instantaneous value of the power supply provided, but better to the average of the input, let's say, signal. This is interesting to us for answering the question, because if a system is sensible to the average of what is it is given in input to itself, clearly this system is not a fast response system. Instead, we could consider it as a quite slow system, and clearly the example of the sheep is intuitive from this point of view. Therefore, the choice between partialization and the selection of the periods, first of all, is not so dramatically important, but it is in favor of the selection of the periods. In fact, typically the partialization, that is the selection of a certain interval of time within the period of the signal, just to provide a supply to the system that we want to manage, is suitable for those systems that are characterized by a fast response. And this is not the case. Therefore, we can decide, for example, that the supply is given to the sheep, to the motor, I mean, of the sheep, one period every three, so as to provide the 30% of the signal to the motor itself. Considering that the frequency of the signal that is applied typically is in the order of the hertz, hundreds of hertz, perhaps 50 hertz, it is clear that the time that we are waiting for providing the necessary signal is around 60 milliseconds. Therefore, it is not so slow the response that we are, let's say, implementing with the particular system that we are controlling. The third question that is made is about the transmission of data by means of a CAN protocol. In particular, the question asks, what is the total time necessary for transferring data if two devices communicate with a throughput equal to 0.1 megabit per second? They are located at a distance equal to 500 meters, and they communicate with the CAN bus protocol, exchanging 32-bit identifiers in a half duplex way. For the answer to this question, I suggest to take the slide number 93 of the digital communication block that depicts a situation in that case involving the presence of a PLC device, but in any case very similar to the one that is considered in this case. In fact, we have a source of an information, in that case a push button system, in this case a generic transmitter. Then we have a receiver device, and we have a bus. In this case there is no presence of an intermediate device like a PLC, but simply the communication is direct between the two interlocutors. Second, while in the previous case no protocol of communication was specified, in this case the problem is focused on the CAN bus communication protocol. This means that the amount of the data that are exchanged between the two partners onto the bus features the presence of a real content, plus, let's say, an overhead of data that are related to the correct management of the protocol. What it is very useful of that example is the general idea that rules the data communication. In other words, what it is interesting to focus is the sequence of steps into which the communication is organized. That is, first of all, when one of the two partners want to communicate something to the other part, it is necessary to configure the port that is related to the communication, and in that case probably we were talking about user port. In this case we don't specify the device, but we say that the communication is at a velocity equal to 0.1 megabit per second. That is, if we establish the total amount of data that are exchanged between the two devices, we know that the velocity with which the data go onto the bus is 0.1 megabit per second times the number of the bits. What kind of information is exchanged between the transmitter and the receiver? The text says that the communication is organized in an handshake fashion. This is very suitable with respect the CAN bus organization, because we know that in the CAN bus protocol, first one of the two interlocutors sends a remote frame onto the bus, that is a request for a certain information that must be received. Then, between the remote frame and the answer of the interlocutor, we will have an interframe that at least is three, let's say, time quantums long. And after this, we have the answer of the partner that in, let's say, CAN bus language is called data frame. And we know that the number of the bits of the data frame are the same for what concerns the overhead, all the informations, let's say, surrounding the real content that is exchanged, plus the real content itself, that in this case is called identifier, and in the text is, let's say, sized 32 bits. Therefore, it is possible to envision a communication exchange like this. First of all, remote frame, and you can calculate the number of the bits that correspond to the remote frame sent by one of the two partners to the other. Then you can consider the interframe, but be careful. In this case, we have to remember that the interframe can be 3 bits long, but it can be even longer if the node is passive or not, is error passive or not. You remember surely, in fact, that there is a field called suspend transmission that is 8 recessive bits long, and is used by those nodes that feature a transmission error rate that is not negligible. In other words, the transmission for those nodes that are quite critical is prolonged, is not made available immediately. Therefore, we can make the hypothesis that the partner, let's say the interlocutor, is not error passive, therefore the answer is immediate, and we can assume that the length of the interframe space is 3 bits. Okay? Otherwise, we can make the opposite assumption and we can add other 8 bits. After this, we consider the number of bits relative to the data frame, therefore start of frame, identifier, RTR, IDE, R0, DLC, CRC, acknowledge, and E end of frame. The same bits as in the case of the remote frame, plus the 4 bytes of data that are the real content exchanged by between the two partners. And this means that at the end of this, let's say, part of the answer, we know how many bits are exchanged between the two interlocutors. This quantity multiplied by the velocity, the throughput, 0.1 megabit per second, provides the time necessary for the data from the sender and from the receiver to be put on the transmission media. Now we have to consider the latency due to the fact that the two partners of the communication are not close, but they are located at a distance equal to 500 meters. The time necessary to cross, let's say, this distance is related to the nature of the medium that is used for the transmission. That is, if we are considering optical fiber, clearly the velocity is comparable to the velocity of the light. Therefore, the time component, let's say, in the overall time necessary for the data communication is very negligible. If we are considering instead a normal cable, for example a coaxial cable, it is advisable to consider a velocity in the order of, let's say, 10,000s of kilometers per second, and clearly this velocity related to the space, very short, that separates the two partners of the communication, provides the time necessary to reach the destination. In any case, the time will be given by the ratio between distance and velocity, and what is different is the velocity depending on the particular medium that we are considering for the transmission. At the end of the calculations, we will discover that in any case, this component of the time is very small, we could say negligible, compared to the time components that are given by the communication protocols. For what concerns the question number 4, I suggested to make reference to the slide 14 of the digital interfacing block. In fact, the question is, why a free state buffer is necessary when a device makes access to a bus? The following slides illustrate the concept of a free state buffer and a certain set of components that can be found on the market. But the specific, let's say, issue is shown in slide 14, where we see that it is necessary to decouple a generic device that makes access to a bus, for example to the data bus, with respect to the other possible devices that perform the same access. The typical situation that we have in mind is the data bus of a microprocessor or, for example, the address bus, to which, for example, we could imagine that the access is allowed to the RAM memory, to the ROM memory, to the CPU itself, to the ALU, I mean, and eventually to a set of devices that implement the peripherals, for example, serial or parallel ports. Every one of these devices can read or write a content onto the bus. But it is clear that to avoid conflicts, only one at a time should be allowed to do this. How to decouple the others? How to prevent the others from influencing the electrical state of the lines, of the bits, of which the data bus consists? It is necessary to, let's say, raise a wall in electronic terms to allow that only one device at a time makes the right access to the bus. The slide 14 shows what is the nature of this wall raised between the device and the bus. We see the data bus, we see the so-called input pins that represent the connection between the device and the external world, and the buffer-free state decouples, separates, let's say, the two entities, external world and device, and let the information pass towards the external world, or conversely, if it is the case, from the external world towards the device, depending on two factors. First of all, the output of the decoding unit that corresponds to the activation of the device that can read or write the information from or to the data bus, that is, can interact with the data bus itself. You see, conceptually, that the address bus is sent to the decoding unit, and if the address value put onto the address bus will correspond to the memory mapping of the device that must interact with the data bus, the corresponding output line of the decoding unit will be active. Therefore, we could consider that the conditions for enabling the device to make access to the data bus are present. But this is not enough, because also the device has been activated. The real access to the bus depends on the fact that an instruction relative to the access to the data bus is going to be executed. And clearly, this instruction will be a read or a write instruction. In assembly, let's say, language, we could say that a load or a store instruction is going to be run, to be executed. Therefore, we will need a control signal that will be sent, activated by the control unit, and contemporaneous to the right address of the device that is enabled, to be present so as to make the wall to go down. And this is the meaning of the picture, into which you see the output of the decoding unit, and in this case the read signal that comes from the control bus, in the hypothesis that the microprocessor is executing the instruction that reads an information coming from the external world. And if both are active, the AND gate will provide a signal that will be connected to the enable pin of the buffer free state. This is the logic, and this is the reason why we need such a kind of device to interface the microprocessor with the external world, or more generally speaking, devices that should make access to a bus that is shared among them. The successive slide, number 15, illustrates the activity of a single free buffer stage with the couple of MOST circuits, one responsible for transferring the information and one responsible for really activating the line. And let's say the particular interesting issue is related to the fact that if the command input that corresponds to the enable signal in the previous slide is not active, no signal is physically put onto the bus because the two MOS devices are not active. Therefore, the circuit doesn't affect the status, the electronic status of the bus line to which it is connected, and this means that the content of the data bus will be determined by another device, but surely not by this one. And finally, in slide 16, you remember that we have presented a couple of commercial components that can be found and used for the same purposes that we have just now explained. The only thing that was different in those two components was the shape, depending on the particular location onto a board into which they must be located. It is preferable that they should have. And this is the answer to the fourth question. The last question is related to the usage of an adapter in a motor, probably in a direct current motor, considering the equations that we are going to describe. And it says, why it is possible to say that an adapter reduces the effect of the disturbances on the load of a motor? The right slide that we can consider to answer to this question is the number 80 of the digital interfacing block, into which we clearly see the torque expression considering a motor that is characterized by the presence of an adapter and, of course, of a load that must be moved by the motor itself. In the picture, we see what is the role of the adapter that clearly is made by a couple of wheels. The first, for example, with a reduced radius, and the second with a large radius. So as there is an integer relationship, multiplication factor, we could say, between the generic angular displacement of the motor and the object connected to the second wheel, the big wheel. Therefore, if the motor performs a rotation equal to theta m, the rotation of the system connected to the adapter will be theta, and theta will be equal to theta m divided by n. The same, reduction factor, we could say in this case, must be considered for the velocity and for the acceleration. Another observation that you can see in this slide is that the equation xi times tau c times theta prime motor equal to tau prime multiplied by theta prime provides a certain degree of conservation of the mechanical power. In other terms, we are considering the quantity tau c that is related to the torque provided by the motor to what it is connected to it, time, the velocity, its own velocity, rotational velocity. Therefore, the product tau c and theta prime m is the mechanical power provided by the motor. This quantity should be equal to the mechanical power received by the object connected to the motor itself, that is tau prime time the angular velocity, considering the presence of the adapter. But we have to foresee the possibility that a certain part of this mechanical power provided by the motor is lost due to passive components that are present, and for example not perfect adherence between the adapter, the wheel connected to the motor, and the wheel connected to the device that we want to make to rotate at a lower velocity. Therefore, the idea is that tau c, the torque provided by the motor, is equal to tau prime, the torque obtained by the motor itself, divided by n c, where n comes from the relationship between the velocity of the motor and the velocity of the rotating object. Nxc is the factor that explains how part of the mechanical power provided by the motor is lost and is not completely, let's say, transferred to the mechanical system connected to the motor itself. If we develop, let's say, this equation, we obtain that the torque tau c can be considered equal to three terms. The first is the inertial term, that is the part of the torque that is spent to win the inertia. And we remember that this quantity is related to the product of the inertia coefficient times the acceleration, angular acceleration of the object. Therefore, we have Jc times theta second derivative function divided by n squared times xc plus bc times the derivative function of the angular displacement divided by n squared xc. This is the part of the torque that is devoted to win the friction. And finally, we have a term that takes into account the potential, the possible presence of a disturbance d prime divided by n xc. And this is the real answer to the question without continuing in the analysis of the equations. We see that the effect of the disturbance is divided by n xc, that has been already considered a minute ago when we wrote the expression that connects the torque provided by the motor to the load to the effective torque received by the load itself. In the expression, therefore, d prime is divided by n, that is a number greater than 1 and the integer. Therefore, this demonstrates that the presence of the adapter reduces the effect of the disturbances onto the load. Finally, let's look to the ARM code that is presented into the text, and let's try to comment the single instructions and to identify the general function, the general role that is played by this code during the execution. Clearly, we are seeing that there is an intense usage of the stack area. That is, this is a subroutine that probably receives some parameters and destroys during its execution some registers that therefore must be saved into a proper area, the stack area, to restore the status of the elaboration when this routine is finished. The routine takes three parameters that are received in R0, R1, and R2. R0 is a value that is typically used, looking at the instructions in the body of the routine, to address the memory. Therefore, will be suitable pointer to a certain memory location on which we need to perform a specific operation. And R1 and R2 are two elements that at the beginning, if you look at the instructions, are compared, and basically we exit from the code when their distance is close to 1. It seems that R1 and R2 can be considered two indexes that are related to the memory location pointed by R0, and when the first reaches the second, basically the execution of the routine is finished, can be considered terminated. We could start to think that R0 points to an array, and R1 and R2 could be considered two indexes, and in particular the starting point of a certain part of the array, and R2, the ending point of the same array, maybe the beginning and the end. This said, we can analyze the code on an instruction by instruction basis. First of all, we see that we have a store of more registers in the stack pointer that is declared as a full descending, but this is not important. R4, R6, and the link register, just to save the return address. And this makes us to think that this could be a routine that calls itself, because when we save the link register into a stack area, this means that we will call other routines or ourselves, and therefore it is necessary to save the link register, otherwise we don't know where to jump when we have finished the execution. In any case, move R6 is charged with R2, and this clarifies the need for saving into the stack area that before has been done. R2 is one, of course, of the parameters that has been received. And now we have the couple of instructions that suggested us that R1 and R2 are two indexes of a suitable memory area, because if you see, we make R6 minus R1, that is R2 minus R1, and the result is put in R7 and compared with 1. That is, if one border of the memory area and the other one are close to 1, look, load from the stack pointer, load the link register to the PC, and jump back. That is, the routine is finished. Good. We could make one step beyond, considering that R1 is, let's say, one limit term of the array that is pointed by R0, and R2 is the other one. Let's consider, let's assume that R1 is the left limit of the array that we are considering, and R2 is the right limit of the array that we are considering, or the part of the array that we are considering. And let's go on. If the two indexes are not so close, the next instruction that we perform is a load from the memory, that is, the element pointed by the left term is charged in R7. Look at the fact that we are doing R1, we perform an arithmetic shift left by two position, and we add this amount to R0. Then we add R1 to R1, and we write this in R2, and we move R6 in R4. What we are doing exactly? If you consider the operations that we have done, basically we have recovered, we have read a central element, let's say a pivotal element into the array, and we have charged it into R7. Then we have incremented the R1 index, that is the left index, and we have charged R6 in R4. R6 was the original R2 and was the right element of the array. And now we perform another load in R3, this time, of R0 plus another index, that is R2, again shifted two position, arithmetically speaking, left. That is, we are charging in R3 the value of the array pointed by the R2 element that was left plus 1. And we are comparing this element, this value, with R7, that was the pivotal element read previously. The comparison, of course, has an exit, that is, if the element R3 is lower than the pivotal element, we shift to the next element, R2 is added with 1, and branch less equal partition test, that is, look, we compare R2 with R4, that is, we are comparing if the left element is less than right or not, and if this is the case, we jump to partition loop and we continue with the iteration. If instead the previous comparison between R3 and R7 failed, let's say it's not less equal but is greater, we decrement R4. Remember that R4 is the right element of the array, the portion of the array that we are considering. And look, we load from the memory the element of the array R0 pointed by R4, shifted two position left. We store into it the element pointed by R2, and R2 was the generic element that we have considered, the left element, and we store the R3 previous element in R0, the array, plus R4 shifted to position left. That is, we are swapping AL and AR, the left element and the right element. And then we continue with the test if the left and the right are still one minor than the other one. In this case, we continue to iterate, otherwise we stop the execution of the program. And this gives us the idea that probably we are performing not only a swap in the position of the array, but we are trying to find a suitable order in the elements of which the array is composed, consists of, I mean. Okay, if the comparison between R2 and R4 is not less, that is, if R2 is greater or equal than R4, we exit from the partition, we subtract, we decrement the left element, that is, we consider the next one in the list, and we swap exactly as before. This time R0 plus R2 properly shifted, and R0 plus R1 properly shifted. Remember that R2 was pointing the left element, and R1 was pointing, you have to go back some instructions, the pivotal element. That is the three instructions: load, store and store, swap, AL and the pivot. And then we branch to again the beginning of the function, that is, we call the function once more, because basically we are exploiting the same procedure with arguments again. The array R0, the left that is in R1, and the right term that is in R2. And let's say, when doing iterations after iterations, we end and we exit from this point, simply we move R4 in R1 and we branch to this label tail call entry that. Is the beginning of is at the beginning of the routine itself. Okay, what we can say from this analysis? Surely this is a nested routine. Second, it is quite clear that the routine calls itself several times, and now it can be considered the set of the instructions that perform those swaps between AL and AR or AL and the pivot. Therefore, we can say that probably this kind of routine is implementing a certain level of sorting on the elements of the array itself. What kind of sort is in course, is in progress, let's say? Of course, we need to perform an example to understand better if this is a quick bubble merge or whatever. The picture shown in the solution clearly demonstrates that this is a quick sort applied on an array, in this example made of 7 elements. The left element is 10, the right element is 70, and the list of elements is unordered. Every time the partition is made around the last element. Therefore, we consider 70 and we separate the group of the elements on the basis of those that are lower than 70 and those that are greater than 70. Therefore, we have two new lists. The first is made by 10, 30, 40 and 50. The second is made by 90 and 80 that are greater than 70. Now let's apply the iteration again. If we apply just to quickly conclude the iteration to the right group, I mean the one made of 90 and 80, the last element is 80, therefore the remaining element is 90, and we have finished the application of the algorithm to this last part of the subgroups into which the array has been subdivided. Considering instead the list located in the left part, we apply the partition to the last element 50, and of course we remain with 10, 30 and 40. Now the element to which we need to apply the partition is 40, therefore we remain with 10 and 30, and finally we have only 10. After having applied the partition to the last element, that is 30. Therefore, now we have a group of elements that are correctly ordered: 10, 30, 40, 50, 80, 70, 80, and 90. And the array can be ordered in a proper way from the lowest value up to the highest value. But in particular, the number of the steps that was required to converge was very, very short. And basically, in four iterations, we arrived at the right order of the array. Okay, I think that for today, it could be considered enough, and I think that also for the course it could be considered enough, since we have seen four sections and we have seen some applications of the concepts that we have learned in the course at typical and real industrial problems. We have seen how to calculate the time necessary for the communication at CAN bus. We have seen situations that allow us to evaluate the frequency of a train of pulses on the basis of the real number of bits that are available to a microprocessor to perform the acquisition. We have seen the memory map, how to design the architecture that interfaces a CPU with the memory blocks and the peripherals that it must drive and control. We have seen also some approaches to the interpretation of the ARM code, and we have seen also that the XAM is made sometimes of questions that are specifically related to the topics that we have dealt with in the lessons, just to verify if not the theory, but the basic mechanisms that rule the activity of many of the actuators and devices that we have seen in the course have been thoroughly understood. Okay, I remain at your disposal for questions. You can write by email at my address, or if necessary, we can fix an appointment by Zoom, by one of the platforms that are available now, just to discuss together the issues and the problems that you can meet during the preparation of the exam. And thank you for listening. I hope that also this year was dramatically affected by the pandemia. The recording of the lessons, the material that have been put onto the website, trying to improve the slide, was sufficient to follow the lessons in a fruitful way. In any case, as I said, we can meet once more to go better into the details. Thank you.